Hea ka aha ho o kolokolo ki ke hanohano ua a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened. Te noho I lalo. Please be seated.
All right, please call the case.
Call to case number SCA-18-732, United Public Workers, the Kishimoto et al. Arguing for the appellant, Rebecca Holmberg. Arguing for the appellee, Jim Halverson. Also at the appellee table, Richard Thompson. Arguing.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Covert, Mr. Halverson. Are you both ready to proceed with your arguments today?
Yes,
all right. Ms. Covert, you reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. We'll give you a warning at 10 minutes. With 10 minutes to go, Mr. Halverson will give you a five-minute warning. Please proceed. Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning.
This case came about going back 2003-2004 time period. In that time period, UPW was pursuing parallel paths to address what it saw was an issue regarding the civil service status of employees working in the public charter schools, specifically Bargaining Unit 1.
Do you need some water? If you want to take that, it's fine.
Culminated on March 15th, 2004, when a stipulation and agreement, an order, was entered involving both UPW and HGA and the Department of Education Superintendent, Ms. Hamamoto. It came about because in 2003, UPW with HGA had pursued one prohibited practice complaint before the board involving civil service status of the charter school employees, and also named as a party the DHERD, Department of Human Resources Development, because in beginning in June of 2003, they were mandating that the Department of Education stop seeking names for placement in civil service positions with charter schools. The UPW had also pursued, which is the case that has now come before you, a separate complaint on behalf of a bargaining unit employee at Connections in the Big Island in Hilo, because he had been let go and without bargaining with the union. His work had been contracted or privatized out to either independent people or the owner of the building had cleaners coming in. And they had not recognized the union. In fact, the union had no notice that this action was being taken to Mr. Asing until he came to them, actually until his name appeared in a list of employees who would be affected by the changes to the civil service status of employees at charter schools. Discussions then were held between the superintendent and the state director of UPW, and culminated in this stipulation and agreement, which is starting in docket.
There you go. Ms. Covert, you said that Mr. Asing first learned about it when UPW received a list of employees. That was July 3rd. So you're saying that he did not know on May 6th?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I misspoke. The union did not know about the termination action until after receiving that July 3rd and after the Connections had already taken the action to inform Mr. Asing he was let go.
And didn't they inform him that he should talk to his union?
That is the claim that the made by the, I call him the principal. I think they may have had different titles back at that time period, but the principal, Mr. Thatcher, is claimed on the testimony that he told Mr. Asing even earlier to go talk to your union because you may not be renewed. Mr. Asing denied that he had been informed by that, and Mr. Kadota, who was a division director, testified that he talked to Asing back when he first became civil service in 2001 and then did not talk to him again until after getting the list in July of 2000.
But Ms. Covert, I think you're moving to the point where you're explaining why the stipulation does not apply to Mr. Asing.
It does apply, and it was when so the stipulation was reached as to address what was happening to the recognition of civil service status of charter school employees. and it was broadly drafted. It starts on 25-588, and it recognizes that the Ms. Hamamoto recognized that there were approximately 150 classified positions of the DOE in charter schools. And then it recognized that the civil service status of these employees had been brought into question. And then it provides that the DOE stipulates and agrees to cease and desist from implementing the what DHERD was claiming was no civil service, and to make whole all adversely affected, the word affected was left out. But
so if the stipulation applies and it's meant to make whole, you said it does apply then.
Yes.
Why doesn't it make Mr. Ussing whole?
Well, that was the union's position. And the and in 2000, in the HLRB proceeding with Mr. Ussing, the HLRB agreed on summary judgment back in 2000. I think the order was in 2007, but agreed that Mr. Ussing was covered by the stipulation. And they found that the DOE had taken action to separate him from his employment and his civil service status. At the same time, DHERD was announcing that these employees were not civil service. So
the argument, though, is that that action was taken for a separate reason, that there were budget challenges at the school. And is that your understanding of the argument? And if so, what's the state of the record in terms of disputes of material fact with regard to that issue?
Well, that is one of the points that the board, because that the second board, the reconstituted board on remand, found that that he was let go anyway because he was had an expiration date of June 30th, 2003, and the school said it didn't have funds to continue the janitorial services. There's some dispute because he was given different reasons on why he was let go, but I believe that was the predominant view that the board took.
And if that's the case, then he still would come under the STIP, even though he'd been released for other reasons?
Yes, because if you look at 76-26E, I'm sorry, 76-27, it does, in subsection B, and this is an argument made by opposing counsel in their brief, that civil service employees with a limitation date shall have no layoff rights and shall be released at the end of their appointment or earlier for lack of work, lack of funds, or other legitimate reasons. But it also has subsection E, which states that an employee with that limitation date, if they were hired into a civil service position, then are provided the right to be placed into a vacant position.
Was he hired into a civil service position?
He was. And so if you look at the record, you'll see he was first hired as a temporary employee and then a non-civil service employee. But in the record, there's a separation notice where he is separated from that job and hired into the civil service position, which is the one he held at the time he was terminated.
So under your position, he would have had that right to go into another position.
Right.
Even though he had been let go for economic reasons.
Right. Because under that stipulation agreement, too, Ms. Hamamoto was stating that these employees are under the DOE civil service system.
Would that your analysis be the same if we were to decide that the stipulation did not include Mr. Ussing?
If you decide that Mr. Ussing was not covered by the stipulation, then I would have you look at our position as to the errors made by the board in decision 491. And in their part of it, they found he was not covered by the STIP, but they also made other findings, and they found that there was no duty to bargain. And they unusually, they found there was DOE had no duty to bargain. They never addressed whether Connections had a duty to bargain. And so if you find that the STIP does not cover Mr. Ussing, we would ask you to still set aside decision 491, decided by the reconstituted board, because he did have those rights as a civil service employee to be placed in a vacant position. They never offered, the school nor Connections nor the DOE never offered it to him.
Under 76, you're talking about 7627. You're saying that, assuming he's not covered by the STIP, and assuming that they declined to renew his contract because of financial reasons, 7627 still applies?
E would kick in.
D?
E, like Edward. And he should have been offered vacant positions. That was never offered to him. And because the union wasn't informed, the union couldn't have helped to say, wait a minute, he's civil service, put him into a position at the time before he was separated from his employment.
Would it be a vacant position at the school or somewhere else? Or what? Where would the vacant position potentially be at?
Well, even if you don't find Al Singh covered by the STIP, you have where the Ms. Hamamoto was stating that these charter school employees are within the DOE civil service system. So it's a vacant position anywhere in the DOE civil service positions.
But that was on the STIP. So well, if he's not covered by the STIP, I understand the three other employees were placed in other positions, but because he was let go before, not on that reason, he was let go before because of a lack of funds. And if there's sufficient evidence in the record to support that decision, you're saying they still have an obligation to place him in another position?
Yes, because he was civil service. He had an expiration date in a position he held, which was civil service, and he was hired in that position.
Even if it's a not-to-exceed date of his contract of employment?
I ask you to look at 76-76, an employee serving an appointment with a limitation date may subsequently be appointed to the same position or a related position in the same class within the department when a permanent position is established or is vacated, provided that the employee was hired initially through civil service recruitment procedures and the period of service as a temporary appointment immediately preceded the appointment to the permanent position.
What statute was that again?
76-27.
And I'm sorry?
76-27.
27.
But, even though his contract was not to exceed a certain date, you're saying he's still considered a permanent employee?
No, I'm saying that
he just said that the statute that you just cited said he was a limited term employment, and then he could be considered a permanent employee. But if he's not a permanent employee, how does that statute apply?
That if he's a limited term appointment with an expiration date, and at that point when he is about to be released, there is a permanent position that is vacant, he may move into that position.
That's true of all employees with NTE dates, or would he be characterized as an exempt employee, or is that not an accurate term to use in this instance?
I would avoid that. I would just say that he was civil service because civil service is both temporary and permanent positions. And he was moved into that position, a civil service position, hired into that position, and that he would qualify for the right to be placed. And he wasn't placed, and there was no bargaining over it when they decided not to.
So if, say, the judiciary has summer employees, and we have them all the time, every summer, we're used to anyway. Every summer we hire people for 3 months, usually students. Though that's a temporary employment, right?
That sounds like an 89-day hire.
I don't think they were. But suppose they weren't an 89-day hire. So suppose it was suppose we hired somebody for the legislative session. And in 96 or 90, whatever it was, the economy took a terrible turn. We just had to cut our budget horribly. We still would be obligated to find another place for those people?
No, you're not obligated. If a position has been created, not required to be created, but if it has been created, or if there's a vacancy.
You have to look for another position to put.
But you're not required to place
a limited term employee.
And it's not a bumping right, in other words.
Right. So he can't use, I've been here 3 more years and that guy over there, I'll take his job. It has to be a vacant.
For which he's qualified.
So,
I'm
so sorry.
He has to be qualified for the position.
I think it's to a same class within the department. So I think with the same class, he would have to be qualified inherently with being in the same class.
I'm sorry.
I have a follow-up question on 7627E, where it says, provided that the employee was hired initially through civil service recruitment procedures and the period of service as a temporary appointee immediately preceded the appointment to the permanent position.
Yes.
So does he qualify under that last phrase?
The one
period
about
of service as a temporary appointee immediately preceded the appointment to the permanent position.
No, because they let him go without telling him. They didn't treat him as civil service. They didn't tell him that there are some vacant positions, so go now before we terminate you. Before that June 30th, you better go now. And the union didn't hear about it until after that. Otherwise, Mr. Division Director had said, you know, that's what we would have done. We would have looked for a vacancy to move him into.
And even if it was another school or
yes.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't a permanent employee, right? Do those rights accrue to a permanent employee?
Well, that's, I think, the permanent employee's rights go to bumping. They go, it doesn't even matter if it's...
So he's not a permanent employee. Mm-hmm. He was a limited-term employee.
If that is what was on the
if
record.
If he's a limited-term employee, then how does that statute, I don't have it in front of me, how does that statute read that he can then, I thought you had to be a permanent employee in order to move into a vacant position. You're saying a limited-term employee has a right to move into a vacant position.
Into a vacant position if they do it prior to the expiration of their limited-term appointment date. And they were hired into that position as a civil service.
And what was his limited term employment date? Was it
June 30th?
What about the duty to bargain, if you could focus on that briefly?
I would like to. So the duty to bargain was, again, they found no duty by the Department of Education. And they found that, I think, from the decisions this court has made, well informed about the duty to bargain over mandatory subjects. And I would quote to you from an arbitration award, but I thought it was well stated. And if wages are the heart of the labor agreement, job security may be considered its soul. The transfer of work customarily performed by employees in the bargaining unit must therefore be regarded as an attack on the job security of the employees whom the agreement covers, and therefore one of the contract's basic purposes. And in this case, he was let go for financial reasons was the reason given. That's one of the basic, best ways to negotiate, have a duty to bargain. Because if it's about money, maybe we can reduce his hours. Maybe we can come to an agreement about his rate of pay. Maybe we can make some adjustments so he doesn't lose his job. That was never offered by Connections, and they never gave the union notice until after the action was taken. They never gave the union notice. The union found out about it when Mr. Al-Singh came in with his papers.
So in every case where there is just one employee who is let go for financial reasons, the employer is obligated to bargain?
We would say yes. Because if they can do that to one employee, they'll do it to the other employees and the job security of all the employees.
Well, we're not talking about, it's understandable if they're getting rid of a whole bunch of employees or they're eliminating their positions or deciding to privatize, whatever, like in this case. But this is just one employee that a charter school was trying to reduce their overhead.
They find
one employee with a small employer, they have to bargain.
Yes, and they bargain over the effects of it. And
does the statute make any distinction between one and two employees?
Sitting here, I can't tell you that it does. If you're aware of something.
No. I'm just saying the statute seems to say that it shall be a prohibited practice for a public employer to willfully violate the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. It doesn't talk about one employee or two.
No, I, that's why I'm not aware of anything in Chapter 89 that...
Ms. Covert, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but how do you respond to the position that Mr. Al-Singh had a duty to file a grievance?
Well, I think there's, that came in the context of the board saying it would not decide a violate, actually it came in the context of the board saying it would not decide a violation under 8913A8, which is failure to follow the collective bargaining agreement. But it also found that they would not address the duty to bargain because he failed to file a grievance. And so they applied the exhaustion doctrine in both of that. And so I think there's a different additional arguments under the duty to bargain waiver or use of the exhaustion doctrine under the duty to bargain.
Aren't they separate? It would seem to me, and I'm not very familiar with this area, but it seems it's one thing when the employee wants to file a grievance because it affects him. The employee, but when the union files it, they're trying to protect the position, aren't they? In other words, they're trying to keep this position from being going out to being privatized.
Yes.
So their interest can go far beyond the grievance. I mean, in fact, the employee may say, look, I'm done. I'm going to retire. You know, I don't really care. But the union can say, wait, we care about this position. This is part of something, you know, that we had a collective agreement, and we want to preserve this position, and we don't want it going out to being privatized. Wouldn't they have their own interest?
Yes, they have a separate and a larger, greater interest than that employee, one individual.
I want to make sure I understand. I'm sorry.
You had your duty as a representative of Mr. Asim to file a grievance. You're representing him. Okay. So you're representing him. I mean, I understand the theoretical about the theory of you don't want these positions to be privatized, you don't want, but he's your union member, and you represent him.
And so the punishment is I don't get to go and file an unfair labor practice?
Should you have filed the grievance?
Well, that's not the question here, though.
Isn't it?
No. The question is whether the union can pursue a prohibitive practice for a willful violation of the collective bargaining agreement, even though it chose not to pursue a grievance on it. And when you go to a grievance, you don't have to show willful. You have to show willful under 8913A, any of those subsections. And the statute provides that the board shall decide that.
Why wouldn't you have filed a grievance, though? If it protects his rights.
Because the union was focusing on the two prohibited practices complaints that it was pursuing.
Regarding the other employees?
Yes. Regarding all the employees, and including Mr. Asing and the separate grievance that's here before this case.
Did you say separate grievances?
Separate complaints, okay, before the board. Thank you.
I want to make sure I understand the construct here. You are saying that if Mr. Asing was covered by the stipulation, we don't reach the prohibited practice? The issue?
You would reach the prohibitive practice because the board has held in this case, the first board held in this case, and subsequent earlier boards have also held that if there's a agreement reached and it's breached, that's a prohibitive practice. That's okay. A violation of the duty to bargain and a violation of that agreement.
Okay.
And so that would be and the union alleged a complaint in Mr. Asing violations of those two sections. It started out along a different path, perhaps, but then when the stipulation was reached, the union argued that the facts had now developed where this was the basis to dismiss it. And the board chair said, look, we could be here forever, and we view this stipulation as resolving the matter. The DOE did not comply with that matter, and therefore that's a violation. And on that alone, get Asing back to work, and we all go home. I think I reserve some time.
Very well. Thank you for your argument. We'll wait to hear from you again in rebuttal. Mr. Halverson.
Thank you, Your Honor, members of the court. I'm not going to try to restate the arguments that were set out by my colleague, Mr. Keating, in the answering brief. I know that you've all read it. I just want to clear up a couple of things that have cropped up in the process of this case, which has been going on now for almost 17 years. Back in 2003, there were questions concerning what is the status of charter schools. And the first issue that came up is the phrase in the charter school law. It said something to the effect of Schools designated as New Century Charter Schools shall be exempt from all applicable state laws except those regarding, and it lists collective bargaining under Chapter 89, discriminatory practices under Section 378, and health and safety requirements. So what did that mean? So the Department of the Attorney General was asked to opine on what does that mean, exempt from all state laws. And the opinion that came out in 2003 from the Department of the Attorney General is that because of the context of this law and the omission of naming Chapter 76 as an exception, it was concluded that charter school employees are not civil service.
Has this court ever adopted that holding?
No, I don't believe that has come up to the court.
I'm just curious. Who in charter schools would be subject to Chapter 89, but not 76?
Almost all of the employees are subject to Chapter 89. For example, all the teachers, maybe, where there's some ambiguity there. But custodians would be members of UPW. Cafeteria workers would be members of UPW. Office workers would probably be members of HGA. So that's not been an issue. We've processed grievances.
So there would be HGA members that would not be civil subject to 76?
That is correct. Now, if I can continue on this line, hopefully I'll make it even clearer. So that was the first thing. And that's what prompted some of the activities involving DHERD, Department of Human Resource Development, and DOE related to the stipulation. Is, oh my gosh, they're not civil service. And the then director of Department of Human Resource Development, Kathy Watanabe, put out an edict that says, they're not civil service, so we're no longer going to process them through the civil service recruitment process. And that created all sorts of controversy.
So it was considered retroactive. So if the individual in this case was hired civil service and this Attorney General opinion comes out, that made it retroactive?
He was never hired to civil service. Mr. Austin was hired by the school and did not go through the civil service recruitment process. There was a document that was prepared. I should back up. During this period of time, there was confusion on the part of the Department of Education on what their role was with regard to charter schools, because charter schools do not fall under the Department of Education.
At the time that the school board elected to end his position, was he a civil service member?
No. There was a document that indicated that he had been made a civil servant. That was prepared by a DOE employee without authorization from the school.
When was the stip?
2004. Okay, so 2003, this AG opinion comes out, throws the issue of what's the status of charter school employees. One of the concerns that followed up on that was, what about DOE schools that are converting to charter school? And that's where DOE comes in. That's where the concern of then Superintendent Hadhao Momota was. What happens to the DOE employees in a DOE school that are converting to charter school? And this came up in the context of one on the neighbor island where they were in the process of converting, and when they found out they were going to lose their civil service status, it caused a great deal of consternation. So what did they do? Well, there was the stipulation that Pat Hamamoto entered into, apparently, from my understanding, to address her employees who were going to convert to a charter school. And in fact, the statute that I quoted from before got amended. And this is in 2004. The statute got amended. It specifically said the following, and I'm talking about the same section where it says charter schools are exempt from all state laws, where we had interpreted that to mean it's they're exempt from 76. So in 2004, in Act 664, The legislature added the following provision at the end of that paragraph. Civil service employees of Department of Education schools shall retain their civil service status upon the conversion of their school to a New Century Conversion Charter School. Positions in a New Century Conversion Charter School that would be civil service in the Department of Education public school shall be civil service positions and subject to Chapter 76.
Those are the new schools, the newly formed
conversion charter
schools. Okay, I just heard this.
New schools are two different kinds.
Right, I couldn't hear the second part of what you read.
They're startup charter schools.
Right.
They continue, continue to take a position as startup charter schools, which Connections is, that their employees are not civil service. This law was specifically changed to protect the civil service status of DOE employees who were going to convert to a charter school. That was done in 2004. Now, as an aside, there was another issue that I'll just point out, because it just points out the uncertainty at the time of what DOE's involvement was. We had a conversion charter school, Wailea, here in Oahu. And when it converted to a charter school, DOE continued to provide food services. And we had discussions with the superintendents going, we don't think you should be doing that. And she says, I don't know what authority I have to change that. And in 2003, the legislature amended the charter school law to specify the department, meaning DOE, shall collaborate with the charter school administrative office to develop a system of technical assistance related to compliance with federal and state laws and access to federal and state funds. The department and the charter school administrative office shall collaborate to develop a list of central services that the Department of Education may offer for purchase by a New Century charter school at an annual cost to be negotiated and so forth. So that let pass in 2003, and that resolved the Wailea issue because the superintendent says, okay, it's clear to me now, if I'm going to provide continued services to a charter school, it's got to be on a reimbursable basis. So we're at the beginning of this charter school thing, there were questions, there were uncertainties. One of them was the status of charter school employees. Secondly, what's going to be the status of conversion charter school employees? Three, what's the relationship in terms of providing services? Mr. Ossing was never hired through the civil service system. He was never in a DOE school. He was only in a charter school. I think it's also in the record the reason the Connections was originally on the campus of a DOE school. They moved to Hilo. They went into a commercial building. The commercial building provided, as part of the lease, some janitorial services. Between that and volunteers and classroom cleaners, the expense for Mr. Ossing was not justifiable. But Mr. Ossing was never civil service.
I thought Ms. Covert took the position he was, so is there a factual dispute?
We disagree.
Okay.
We know there's a document in the record that says he was converted to civil service. We had testimony during the HLRB hearing from Connections principal, Mr. Thatcher,
in terms of Ms. Covert cited 7627E with being applicable to limited dates, but that statute does say, provided that the employee was hired initially through civil service recruitment procedures.
Yes,
so you're saying Mr. Ossing was not initially hired through civil service recruitment procedures.
That is correct.
So 7627E would not apply to him.
No, it would not. And it does raise another very interesting question, because charter schools are very unique. As Mr. Thomason and I know very well, they're not DOE schools. They're governed by their local school board. It means we have 30 clients. We have to deal with each charter school as a separate client. But part of that is they're charter school, that it's not a homogeneous workforce. You don't get to move from one charter school to another without the receiving charter school saying, yeah, we'll take him or her. And that's why, in the context of layoffs, the bumping rights, even if they were civil service, are non-existent, because between two charter schools, it's two different jurisdictions.
But at some time in 2002 or 2003, Mr. Ossing was told he was a civil service employee.
Yes, he received a document. It was prepared by Chuck Higgins, who's a DOE employee. Again, DOE wasn't sure what their role was. They set up a charter school office, which is now gone. They finally realized that they've got no business dealing with charter schools unless it's on an arm's-length business thing and providing services. There are some charter schools that do get services from DOE.
But it is your position that even though he was told he was a civil service employee, he wasn't?
He was not.
Now, is that an issue? What's the factual context? I mean, are we deferring to the board's determinations on these issues? So and what are we looking at here? Clear error, question of material fact?
Well, I think that is it. I think you need to look at the overall ruling by the Hawaii Labor Relations Board. One, they said the stipulation, and I think the stipulation should be read in its narrow context. It was being... Pat Hamamoto has no authority over charter schools, but she did have concern about conversion charter schools that had DOE employees.
She must have been also concerned about startup charter schools and the education that the students are receiving.
No, she had no responsibility there. But there's one small exception to that, and that's special ed. The state of Hawaii Department of Education does have some responsibilities in charter schools with regard to special ed, but those are special ed teachers and has nothing to do with civil service. And that's because of a federal requirement. The federal requirement requires that in each state there be one person or one entity designated in charge of special ed for federal purposes.
But you would concede that Mr. Ossing was a member of Bargaining Unit 1, was a member of UPW, correct?
That is correct. We never argue that.
Yeah, and your position is that didn't entitle him to have the union represent him in bargaining?
Well, not in bargaining. I believe the testimony of Mr. Thatcher at the HR hearing, if I recall correctly, was he told Mr. Ossing, you need to go consult your union.
And why isn't this a matter of mandatory bargaining for the union or the employer?
The decision to renew a not-to-exceed appointment has never been bargained that I'm aware of. We have not-to-exceed appointments all over the place. Every deputy in my division has a not-to-exceed appointment, which is usually June 30th. And of course, we don't have bargaining for deputies, but...
Renewed every year.
Pardon?
And those are renewed every year?
Yes, every year.
Well, sometimes they're not when there's a new governor, right? Some of the positions.
Well, so far in my division, have renewed every year. I can't speak for the rest of the department.
So her argument is premised on him being a civil servant. Is that your position?
I believe so. But even if he was a civil servant, and I agree with Ms. Covert that you can be a civil servant and have a temporary appointment. But the whole point was, even if he was a civil servant, he had a not-to-exceed appointment, and it was not renewed, and he was informed in advance of the NTE date, and he chose to leave.
Can I ask you about the prohibited practice complaint and what your position? The agency seemed to rule, the board seemed to rule that he didn't exhaust his remedies or something, or that a grievance should have been filed?
Well, the bottom line is, in a prohibited practice complaint of this nature, I don't know what provision of the collective bargaining agreement we're supposed to have violated.
But they didn't reach that, right? That wasn't the reason. Their ruling was that there should have been a grievance filed. They didn't say that They didn't make a substantive decision, did they, that there's been no violation?
No, they did not. And that would be left up to the grievance process. That's part of the grievance process, to determine whether or not there's been a violation of the contract.
So you're saying there has to be a grievance filed before you do a prohibited practice?
Well, generally speaking, I think that's what that's what this court has ruled in the past in the Poe case. There's got to be an exhaustion of contractual remedies before you can go after the employer.
But does 8913 say that there's a mandatory grievance process that has to be pursued before you can file a prohibited practice complaint?
Is that no, but in the case of in the Poe case, which this court decided many years ago, it was determined that there's a requirement for an exhaustion of contractual remedies before you can go after the employer.
I think she's invoking an exception for intentional or willful violations of the contract. Could be a parallel track.
Well, all prohibited practice complaints require willful.
So you don't believe there's an exception that would be applicable here?
No, I mean, every prohibited practice complaint requires against the employer requires that the employer's actions be willful, be some willful violation of Chapter 89.
So in other words, if in fact an employer decides that they're going to privatize one or 10 positions, whatever it's going to be, and the union feels that they're violating the collective bargaining agreement, unless the employee is willing to go along with the grievance process, there's no recourse for the union to try to challenge the privatization of the positions?
You're asking me a question that's got mixed answers, if you could bear with me. First of all, the union can grieve on their own. They don't have to have an employee grieve. They can bring the action themselves. Secondly, on the issue of contracting out privatization, we've got a separate Supreme Court decision called the Abercrombie case that says jurisdiction over privatization is with the circuit court, not with an arbitrator, not with the Hawaii Labor Relations Board, not with the Merit Appeals Board. We have privatization disputes right now with UPW, and that's a central issue. They want to take it to arbitration.
Was that a prohibited practice in Abercrombie? I can't remember at this point. We just said that it wasn't, primary jurisdiction didn't apply. So it didn't go to HLRB.
Right. It did not go.
But I can't remember what the complaint was. I'll have to go back and find it. Yeah.
I'd have to go back and look, too. I didn't do the Abercrombie
case. But I thought the statute, I'm looking at 8914, and it says, any controversy concerning prohibitive practices may be submitted to the board in the same manner and with the same effect as provided in 3779, provided that the board shall have exclusive original jurisdiction over a controversy, and then it has a few exceptions, but I don't see that privatization is in that list. So you're saying that the board doesn't have jurisdiction on privatization? It has to...
That's exactly right. In the Abercrombie case, this court decided that the circuit court has the jurisdiction on privatization issues. And there's nothing in the collective bargaining agreement, the UPW collective bargaining agreement, that prevents, that prohibits privatization. That can be put into a contract, and it has occurred in some places on the mainland, but it's not in the collective bargaining agreement here where it says you can't privatize.
But is that what the board ruled? I thought the board ruled that they didn't, that you should have filed a grievance, that they didn't, the board didn't say, look, you're in the wrong forum, you should go to circuit court. Is that what the board said?
No.
So that you're giving a different reason than what the board gave.
Yes, I am. The board was focusing on the termination action and the civil service status and the stipulation. They weren't looking at this as a privatization issue.
Well, anything further for the court to wrap up or summarize your position?
I think you've heard enough from me.
Very
thank
well.
You, thank you for your patience and your questions.
Thank you. Ms. Covert, your rebuttal.
I think maybe I can answer some of the questions. Abercrombie started as a civil case.
Excuse me?
The Abercrombie case was a civil case. The union brought a four-claim complaint in that case in circuit court. And it came up to you, and your decision was that the circuit court erred in not addressing the privatization because it did not have, first have to go to HLRB. But this court never held that the HLRB could not look at a prohibitive practice complaint arising under privatization. I'd also point out on the Abercrombie case, the question was whether privatization violated civil service laws and merit principles, and the court held that whether privatization violated civil service laws was a threshold question that must be determined by the circuit court. But they held that the HLRB had jurisdiction over issues related to Chapter 89 and whether they were prohibited practices controversies. And the court held that because Chapter 89 did not require HLRB to first pass on the controversy, that's why the circuit court could go ahead and address it. On the Poe, we would argue to this board that a DFR, duty of fair representation, is a hybrid claim, and you do not have to show willful violation. And so it's just, is there a violation, which is what an arbitrator does. Because the Unit 1 agreement is just, did the employer violate, misinterpret, or misapply the contract? So when you go to arbitration, you don't have to show willful. An employee on a DFR claim doesn't have to show willful.
But the DFR claim is against the union, right?
It's about, you have to bring both. On a DFR, I'm sorry, I call it a DFR, but it's, because that's sort of the terminology.
Okay.
But it's typically brought as a hybrid claim. That the employer violated the collective bargaining agreement and that the union breached its duty to the member.
I see.
Because the employee typically won't file a grievance against the union. They'd have to be filing the grievance.
Is there a DFR claim here?
No.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't, first off, I think Mr. Halverson is putting into the record something that's not in the record related to Mr. Alsing's status, because it wasn't just one incident that addresses his civil service status. Docket 25-425 is his application that the DOA presented to him to fill out. He filled that out. Then you have...
That application was based on civil service?
I'm sorry.
Was it like a civil service application?
Oh, no, it's the same one I see every time I've seen a civil service application. And it represents that in the title. Then 25-431 is a separation notice taking him from that non-civil service position to a DOE position 56376, which is the civil service position he was in when he was let go. And then he passed his 6 months. The deposition of Mr. Helms said that, yes, he had completed it. And then you have docket number 25-438, where that tracks him on July 1st, 2002, holding a temporary position. Then on that same page, it has him moving into a probationary. And then on July 2nd, 2003, it identifies him as conversion to a civil service member. And that is a DOE document that was in the record.
Can you retroactively take away someone's civil service position like that?
I'm sorry, could you ask that again?
Can you retroactively take away someone's civil service status? I mean, turn back the clock and say, look, you've been hired as this, and then come out with some sort of an opinion and say that paperwork all gets superseded and the status becomes something that it wasn't initially.
We would argue you cannot. And we'd argue under your Kuomo'o case that you held that notice to employees who hold civil service positions so they know what's going to be happening to their status is very important.
But Ms. Covert, your position is that notwithstanding whether Mr. Alsing is a civil service employee, he was entitled to, or the union was entitled to pursue the prohibited practice.
Yes. Oh, yes. And we would submit that if you conclude for some reason that he's not civil service, then the restriction in Kono that it's an illegal subject to bargain over privatization is out, we'd argue, is out the window under your, at the end of your decision, it talks about how you'd re-examine that if it was not a civil service position. And if he's not civil service, they had a duty to bargain over the privatization, if nothing else.
and we submit both of them do.
Did HLRB decide whether Mr. Ossing was civil service at the time he was informed that his contract would not be renewed?
I had that question too as I was preparing, and I looked through that decision and I don't see where they actually addressed it. And I think if they had decided he was not civil service, that would have answered the whole question about whether he was covered by the stip in the order. Yeah, but they go into this whole reasoning that they gave on why he wasn't covered by the stip in the order, where they could have just said, not civil service, so not covered by the stip. And so I would submit that it appears that they either dodged the issue or they, but I think that for them to have gone through that analysis, they must have concluded he was. But again, if he is civil service, we still submit that, and if you conclude he's not covered by that stip, and we'd ask you to go back again and look at that broad language in the stip and the history of why that stip came about. Because it wasn't just to cover DOE employees already in civil service. It was directly states that it's about the charter school employees.
Wasn't it the whole brouhaha was about the conversion of the employees from civil service to non-civil service, or I'm sorry, about reducing their position at Connections, but the stip covered employees. Mr. Ossing was different because his position wasn't renewed because of financial reasons, and that wasn't true of the other ones, was it?
Well, we were focusing on Mr. Ossing for that case. The board has never concluded the other case to know who were the other employees and how were they affected. But
so there's other employees out there that it's unclear what their status was still.
Yes.
And they were covered
16 years later, 17 years later.
That case is still sitting at the board. The UAPWHGA case is still before the board on the conduct of the DHERD, particularly with regards to the status of civil service employees in, charter school employees and their civil service status.
Well, anything further to wrap up for the court?
They did undertake, those other employees were civil service employees, did you say?
I think the way Mr. Hamilton argued was to suggest that the superintendent...
What did you just say? What did you just say about whether, the HLRB, it's still sitting there, and the employees were civil service employees?
The union filed the complaint because DHERD and the DOE were taking action, it believed, to withhold the civil service status of charter school employees. And that case brought by UPW and HGA is still pending.
So this case, if this court addresses the issue of whether or not he was civil service, that could have some impact beyond this employee. Is that right?
It possibly could, because if he was covered by this, are there other employees who are similar to him? But I'm not aware of any other employees other than Mr. Ossing who was let go in this time period because of lack of funds. But our position was that the intent was to, if you look at the board's reasoning in granting summary judgment and its reasoning in the oral argument, I think it shows that the board was finding that this was an ongoing problem, and it was hopefully to address the whole mess of civil service status of charter school employees, and that would include Ossing.
However, wasn't a way to address it was by coming to the stipulation. Didn't that stipulation cover the other employees?
We believed it covered all the employees, charter school employees, 150.
And yet they carved out Mr. Ossing to be different from the other employees covered by the stip. So why would they leave that pending and take Mr. Ossing if he was supposed to be covered by the stip and was a civil service employee?
They didn't. I don't know if they carved him out. They just did not put him back to work. And so the union believed that was a breach of the stipulation.
The stip was between the school and the union.
The DOE and the union.
Yeah. Well, anything further to wrap up?
If I could just one second.
No, I think I've touched on them. We would, you know, again, we asked you to take this case for the three issues we thought were particularly of importance, which was the civil service status of employees and the rights that they have, the duty to bargain, and the board's erroneous application of the exhaustion doctrine, that where it has a mandate to decide prohibited practices and precludes the union from pursuing willful violations of agreements, particularly where they have complaints that are multi-claims.
Very well.
Thank you
very much. Thank you to all of our counsel here this morning. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Please rise. Ea ka aha ho'okolokolo kieke hanohano ua a ko ho maila. This honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.